From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, you'll meet the Central Valley woman competing on The Glee Project. It's a TV series that debuts this weekend. Also, Davy Rothbart, creator of Found magazine and a contributor to This American Life, he's now the subject of a documentary. It's called My Heart is an Idiot, and it's about his search for love. And Maniac, a collaborative of multimedia artists, opens a show with national and international contributors in Sacramento. That's coming up this weekend. But first, which is the more pressing issue for California lawmakers today? The budget, still way out of balance, or redistricting, which could send some lawmakers into political limbo? There are important developments in both those issues today. Joining us with details is Capital Public Radio state government reporter Ben Adler, who joins us from our downtown studio. Ben, thanks for being with us today.
Good morning, Jeffrey.
Well, let's start with the budget. At least one house of the legislature is going to be taking some action today, correct?
Yeah, the Senate, and God only knows why, because the Assembly has taken the weekend off and coming back on Monday, which suggests that it's unlikely that there'd be any significant finality, I guess is a good way of putting it, over the weekend. So why are they in session? Senator Daryl Steinberg, the Senate leader on the Democratic side, would tell you that he's convening the Senate because there's 5 days to go until the legislature's constitutional deadline of June 15th to pass a budget. And he wants senators to bring stories from their districts, from superintendents of school districts, and from police chiefs and sheriffs who could say this is what will happen if there is no on-time budget and if there is no certainty in the revenue source for their school districts and departments.
I see. And when do they plan to start discussing this version of the budget?
Right now.
Right now.
10 a.m.
Okay. And do we know why the Assembly has taken the weekend off? Is there some pressing business to be conducted elsewhere, or is it just the way the calendar lined up, or something else?
I would be speculating if I gave you an answer on that one. If you allow me to briefly speculate,
sure.
And really it is nothing more, probably because a deal is not imminent and there's no real point except grandstanding.
Yes.
But that's you know, again, just pure speculation. And again, Democrats in the Senate would say this is not a drill. There are 5 days until the budget deadline, and we got to get this debate going.
And drill being the pejorative term in the legislature, in the Capitol, for legislative votes that are really more theatrical than substantive when people are generally not expecting something to go somewhere. But as you said, the constitutional deadline for sending a budget to the governor is next Wednesday. And there's an extra twist this year because, thanks to the will of the voters, lawmakers will not get paid if they don't send a budget to the governor by June 15th.
Yeah, Proposition 25 approved last fall. And the Democrats at first in the legislature tried to say, hey, we did pass a budget bill. That was back in March, the first round of budget negotiations and debate. And State Controller John Chung, for either political reasons or for, his legal interpretation of the budget, you can look at it one way or another, or one legal interpretation of the proposition one way or another, said that doesn't count. It's not balanced. It relies on revenues that are not there, which would be, you know, approved by voters in terms of the tax extensions. And so that doesn't count. Come back with a real balanced budget by June 15th or you're not getting paid.
So that means it has to be a budget that adds up, which means it can't be depending on hoped for tax revenues from future possible elections.
Unless, I mean, there's a couple of qualifiers to that. You know, you could, as the Senate Democrats are about to debate, their budget includes 1 year of what's being called bridge funding, and then the election would be sometime this year, and then the voters would decide whether the taxes would continue past July 1 of 2012, or whether they would stop at that point. So that's what's before the Senate. And of course, if that passes, that would certainly satisfy Prop 25. And the other possibility is that they could pass an all cuts budget or a budget with cuts and gimmicks, or, you know, any sort of combination. But yeah, it's got to pencil out in one way or another. It does not need to be signed by the governor. It just needs to be passed by the legislature for lawmakers to be paid.
I see. We're talking about the state budget. Ben Adler is Capital Public Radio state government reporter. He joins us from our Capitol studio in downtown Sacramento. Let's hear from some lawmakers.
All right. We'll start with Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg of Sacramento, formerly on the Sacramento City Council, familiar with local and state funding. And he was speaking yesterday, and he referred to a newspaper from a day earlier on Wednesday.
You look at the front page of your newspaper yesterday, the Sacramento Bee, between the U.S. Supreme Court decision where we begin the release of inmates from state prisons to what's going on in the city of Sacramento and cities and counties throughout California with police officers and sheriffs and firefighters being laid off. You look at 20,000 teachers with pink slips. You look at class sizes rising to 35 and 40. This is no game. A funding bridge that gives schools and public safety agencies at least a year of stability is the best way to go here.
Now, what does he mean by funding bridge?
Well, that would be extending the taxes, extending the tax increases from a couple years ago for a year in his term, just so there is stability for school districts and police and other and sheriff's departments in terms of knowing what to plan for. The governor wants to only do that for 3 months or so until a September special election. I do have to say, though, just to fact check the senator a little bit, and I know he sat on the city council and I only covered it, but it's not really true to say that there is a direct correlation between the state budget and the city police department. And I fact checked that with the League of California Cities and got that confirmed. There is, to a greater degree, although not a huge degree, but to a greater degree, some direct connection from the state to county sheriff's departments. But a lot of that comes from funding sources not directly controlled by the state, like sales and property tax revenues that are collected locally. There is absolutely a 100% direct correlation between an on-time and revenue-filled state budget and school districts being funded.
And it's interesting to hear Senator Steinberg refer to this 1 year tax extension as a bridge, because the fiscal year lasts for an entire year. So that bridge would in fact be lasting an entire year and be part of the fiscal year's plan.
Yeah. And I think if you were to ask Republicans, and I did ask a Republican, Bob Huff, who is the top Republican on the Senate Budget Committee, he would say, and Republicans would say, that that doesn't make any sense. And in fact, the governor, or rather Republicans, would say that's a violation of the governor's no taxes without a vote of the people campaign pledge. So I spoke with Huff a couple days ago and asked him to respond to a Democratic assertion that it's not Democrats who are at fault for the needing the bridge now. It's Republicans, because Democrats say Republicans forced the end of talks in March.
The governor came into conference committee and he said, just let the people vote. And then you can even go campaign against it. We got very close on that. The governor called off the talks. I believe that's because they saw in the polls it just wasn't going to pass. And so they could end up spending a lot of money for an election and not have the tax increases they want. Now, the Republicans didn't call that off. The governor called that off. And so we wait two more months. In that time frame, $6.6 billion more than was anticipated in January came into the state treasury. And what happened? Democrats spent that. And they not just want to have the voters decide, as the governor said he would let the people do on a tax increase. He now wants a naked tax, a bridge tax, for at least 3 months. And the speaker would say a year, or the pro tem would say a year. But nevertheless, that's moving the goalpost from where it was in the beginning.
Now, there are always a lot of political calculations when it comes to the state budget, but there's an extra complicating factor this year, and that's the redistricting maps. The lawmakers are not controlling the process this time. This is an independent commission is doing it, and their first draft of the maps came out today. And it's easy to imagine some lawmakers sitting at their desk hitting F5 repeatedly as they look at these draft maps to see whether or not they'll have a political future.
Reload, refresh, refresh. The California Citizens Redistricting Commission started meeting a little over an hour ago. Once they approve the maps, they will be posted on the website. And to be honest, I haven't had a chance to check this morning. Even if I did, I would not be able to analyze them at all. There are a bunch of squiggly lines, and lawmakers know exactly where their districts are, and redistricting experts and political operatives know all about them. But as far as you and me being able to analyze them ourselves, that's going to be a little bit hard. But they will be up on the Citizens Redistricting website, which is wedrawthelines.ca.gov, once the commission approves them. Then the commissioners are going to hold a news conference at the Capitol, deliciously, ironically enough, this afternoon at about 1:30. And I'm sure lawmakers will be keeping a very close eye on that. In fact, who knows, maybe some senators who are debating the budget will stroll downstairs to take a look.
Yes. And if the first drafts hold up, or regardless of whether the first draft holds up, the resulting maps could put some Republican lawmakers in a more liberal-leaning district and put some Democratic lawmakers in a conservative-leaning district. And, of course, that could affect the way they see the budget, the tax decisions, and all sorts of matters.
Yeah, that's right. And by the way, I just went over to the website, and the maps are up. So go ahead, take a look if you want. Follow along with us as we analyze them live on the air. Not. Anyway, yes, it's going to certainly, or it could certainly affect lawmakers' votes on the budget. You could have Democrats who aren't in such safe seats anymore be a little bit more reluctant, or a lot more reluctant, to vote for anything involving taxes. You might see Republicans who have been in safe seats who are going to be in not as safe seats be a little bit more willing to at least put a special election ballot measure out there for voters, if not raise taxes themselves directly. That is probably a long shot for all Republicans, as we heard from Bob Huff, for example, a moment ago. So it really is uncharted territory right here. It's never happened before in California history like this, with the redistricting lines being drawn by citizens and not politicians. So to a great degree, it is going to have to be wait and see.
The final versions of the maps are scheduled to come out in August, right?
Yes, mid-August, August 15th.
Mid-August. Well, that's going to come quickly enough, I guess.
Who knows? So, maybe a budget could wait till after that.
Well, that would not be unprecedented for the budget to only be passed in by mid-August.
So that's 2 months without pay for lawmakers.
Well, that's true. So the state Senate, their floor session started this morning. The Assembly convenes on Monday to start their budget debate. Ben Adler, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Ben Adler, Capital Public Radio state government reporter, joining us from our Capital Bureau in downtown Sacramento. You're listening to Insight. When we come back, you'll meet the Central Valley woman competing on The Glee Project, a TV series that debuts this weekend. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio, I'm Jeffrey Callison. On Talk of the Nation Science Friday today, what do we know about the cause or causes of autism? Also, building a better trap for that elusive substance, antimatter. Plus, a look at natural disasters. You might think they're happening more often, but are they really? And how smart are smart meters? They have the potential to improve the way we use electricity. Sci-Fry starts at 11 right after Insight. Fans of the hit TV show Glee can get a fix this summer from a competitive show on cable. It's called The Glee Project, and the winner will get a guest starring role on the Mothership show's third season. And if you live in the Central Valley, you have a local to root for. That's because one of the contestants, Lindsay Pierce, is from Modesto. She joins us from New York by phone. Lindsay, welcome to Insight.
Hello, thank you for having me.
What do you have to do on The Glee Project to win?
Just be unstoppable. You have to have that star quality, and you have to have a lot of heart and be yourself, and that's what we try to do here.
Now, is this a live competition show like American Idol, or a taped one like America's Next Top Model?
It's taped like America's Next Top Model, but it has the talent of American Idol.
Okay, I'm sure it does. So that means that the winner has been chosen.
It has been, yes.
And you obviously can't tell.
It's one of the most important secrets right now. Unfortunately, we can't reveal it.
Yes, well, that's understood. How did you get onto the show? Were you approached, or did you audition, or both?
Both, sort of. I I sang in Modesto. I did Valley's Got Talent at the Gallo Center in Modesto downtown, and I won that competition. And Robert Ulrich, who is the casting director for Glee and also is the one of the main mentors of the Glee Project, had heard me sing, and I messaged him because he's from Modesto, and I asked him how he had gotten into the business with such class and had stayed himself and had stayed so kind. We, you know, Hollywood is a sea of sharks, and he isn't one. He's lovely. And he messaged me back immediately and said, you know, I would love to answer your questions. And hey, I'm working on this thing called the Glee Project. I would really love it if you would audition. You don't have to, but if you think it's something you want to do, I would love to have you. And so I went down to his office in December and auditioned, and then never thought I was going to hear anything ever again. And then I went to Long Beach auditions. I got called back, and then I made the top 12, and the rest is history.
Wow. Are you a fan of the show Glee?
Absolutely. I wasn't at first, and then I watched, there was a Lady Gaga episode about, you know, embracing your personal self and your style, and, you know, Lady Gaga is very much like that, and I saw the Lady Gaga episode, and the costumes and the story and the music was just incredible, and I fell in love, and I immediately went out and rented, borrowed, a bunch of DVDs of Glee and watched it all, and then continued watching it with the season, and it just stuck like glue.
Do you have any of Lady Gaga's style?
Definitely her individuality. Definitely, embracing that kind of individualness. Not quite so crazy like Lady Gaga, but definitely have some good fashion, I would like to say.
My guest is Lindsay Pierce. She's a Modesto woman and one of the 12 competitors on the upcoming TV show The Glee Project. It premieres this weekend on the Oxygen Channel, and the winner will get a guest role on season 3 of the hit TV show Glee. Now, Lindsay, you're in New York right now. It's kind of noisy. What's going on there?
Right now, I'm in an office for MTV. We're shooting some promotional stuff, and we just got done doing the Today Show, and that was really exciting. I'm in Times Square right now, and I'm just the rest of the contenders are kind of standing about talking. We're just being the family that we are, so that's what we're doing right now.
So you're on the Today Show. You just missed Meredith Vieira.
Oh, did I? Dang it!
Yeah, her last day was a couple of days ago.
Oh,
now.
Love her.
So in this competition show, there are 10 episodes, so there must be a lot of challenges. Are they all related to singing, or do they push you in other directions too?
I can say that every single challenge challenges every single contender in a different way, whether it's, you know, it's something that it's a type of song that we have to sing that we're not used to singing, you know, a certain style, or whether the choreography that we have to learn is intricate. You know, not all of us are dancers, and we're all singers, but every single person, you know, some people are belters and some people are, you know, jazz crooners, and some people are kind of indie and different. Some people sound like Michael Jackson, you know, so we're all unique and we're all different, and the show will challenge us acting wise. It challenges our dance skills. It challenges our constitution and our endurance, because it was definitely pressure and being stuck in a situation where you're thrust into a room, a dorm with 11 other people that you've never really bonded with, and trying to become a family and trying to deal with, you know, not being at home, and you're in a different place and pressed into a situation you've never experienced. And definitely the entire experience was challenging, but so fulfilling, and there was really nothing but growth. It just was lovely.
Yeah, you talked there about the comfort zones of the different contestants. What was your niche coming into this?
Broadway, definitely musical theater. I was very into theater in Modesto, in my hometown, and going in, you know, I have a Broadway voice, and I have, you know, my acting skills are Broadway, so I'm very open, and I project, and I'm very theatrical, and I learned to tone it down in the project. I learned that, you know, television, it's not about moving your arms wide, you know, or making big expressions. It's about the tiny things, the little things, the humanity of acting and singing and dancing, that almost pedestrian self. Just, you have to just be real, because if you aren't, people won't believe you, and you want to be believed because you want your message to be heard.
Yeah, Lindsay Pierce, she's from Modesto, and she's one of the 12 competitors on the Glee Project, which premieres this Sunday evening on the Oxygen Channel. Now, with these taped competition reality shows, one of the key elements that you expect is the drama in the house. Was the drama in the house?
There really is. wasn't much, to be honest. Like, of course, there are times when people don't mesh or people don't quite click or understand each other, but that just comes with time, you know, and sometimes someone says something out of stress or tiredness that, you know, I mean, if we were to watch the show now and hear something negative or critical of another person, we would never take it personally because it's, you know, it's over and we're a family and we all understand that it was a stressful situation, you know, and it's there's no need to kick a dead horse, as it were, to beat down a dead animal. And there really wasn't much drama at all. Definitely not in the beginning. There was a bit in the middle, and I can't really say much to be honest, to give anything away. It's a family, as you know, and sometimes a family can be dysfunctional, and it really is just lovely. They're just all. I'm looking at them right now, and they're fantastic.
Oh yeah, and hopefully they're saying the same about you to their hometown radio station.
Hopefully so. I have a tendency to love people a lot more than they love me back. So yeah. I've been raised with that kind of heart. So just seeing them walking around smiling is really lovely.
I know that a lot of people wonder when they watch shows like this on TV, they think, you know, they must have producers who are egging people on who say, redo that, add a little bit more spice to it. Was there any of that?
Not that I can say, to be honest. The cast and the crew were incredible on the show, and it was really just, there just happened to be cameras there. They just said go, and we were filmed, and they decide what gets put in and what doesn't get put in. And there was really no I would say exhibition, as it were, of, yeah, you know, oh, can you say that a different way? There's nothing like that there.
And do you get to the point where you don't notice the cameras and the microphones anymore?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Always. That's the comfort level that comes with, you know, being, you know, we started filming in February and filming ended in April. And, so it definitely, it changes, of course. There was days, you know, we get up, okay, put the microphone on, and that's the end of that, you know, and they're like, all right, and I don't even notice that camera there anymore. And it just became work. It became everyday life. The reality of the house, home seemed like a dream, and the house seemed like a reality. So it all changed.
I read that you were deaf for the first 6 months of your life. How did you get your hearing, and how has that affected you as a singer?
Well, you know, I don't. I was raised a Christian, and when I was a kid, and so there was really, you know, they didn't really know what to do with me, and they realized at a very young age that I was deaf. And and my dad, you know, one night, I mean, believe what you want, but he prayed over me, and I started crying normally for the first time in my life, and he didn't know what happened. He just prayed that, you know, God would lead me the way that I needed to be led, and that he would keep me safe throughout my life, and that, you know, if it was his will, that I'd be able to hear music, you know, and hear something. And here, you know, I would be able to experience that part of my life. And being able to hear and knowing that I almost wasn't able to definitely makes me appreciate music and makes me appreciate this experience, because had I not had the ability to hear, I wouldn't have had this. But then again, you know, it makes me also put my life in perspective and say, well, what would I have done had I not been able to hear? I would have been part of, you know, the beautiful deaf culture, and I would have been learning sign language, you know, and I would have had a completely different life. Not saying it would have been a worse one, but it would have been a different one, and it makes me appreciate my hair now much more.
Yes. And Lindsay, the winner of the Glee Project gets a guest starring role on the next season of Glee. What is that role, or does it depend on who wins?
Well, the role is a big question mark, you know, kind of like the mystery meat, I suppose. It's kind of a mystery flavor, because Ryan will create the role for the person specifically.
Ryan Murphy, what? Being the creator of Glee and the executive mm-hmm. producer of the Glee Project.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
He will watch us. He will see us and hear us perform, and he decides based on our personality, based on our personal story, based on who we are as individuals. He takes our imperfections, and he will make a story out of us. You know, example, Corey Monteith, who plays Finn on Glee, can't dance, and he went into the show not being able to be a dancer, and And that's part of his character now, is that it's a big joke that Finn can't dance, you know, and Lea Michele didn't get a nose job when everyone in her hometown was getting a nose job, and that became a part of the show, was that she wanted to get one and then decided that she could rise above that and kept her own nose. And, you know, things like that, like Damien or Hannah, you know, Hannah's red hair will come into play, or Damien's, you know, Irish hometown will come into play, you know, sure. if they were to win, or Bryce's, you know, the fact that Bryce broke his neck, you know, things yes. like that. It's all part of, he takes little things about us and creates a character out of it. So it's a big question mark.
Okay. Well, Lindsay Pierce, she's one of the 12 competitors on the Glee Project. It premieres this Sunday evening at 9 on the Oxygen Channel. And she's from Modesto. Lindsay Pierce, best wishes to you, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Lindsay Pierce on the phone from New York, where she's doing press for the Glee Project. You're listening to Insight. When we come back, My Heart is an Idiot, a documentary about Davy Rothbart's quest for love. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. On Monday, the commission that's literally redrawing California's political districts has released the first draft of its maps. We'll talk with a redistricting commission member about how they created those maps. Also, Sacramento Police Chief Rick Brazil on how he plans to handle big cuts to his department budget. And continuing the conversation, it's a documentary about end-of-life care, and it debuts in Folsom. Speaking of documentaries, an unflinching documentary about a quest for love plays this weekend in Sacramento. The film is called My Heart is an Idiot, and the seeker of love is Davy Rothbart, well known to many people as the creator of Found magazine. He's also a frequent contributor to This American Life. He joins us by phone, Davy Rothbart, along with the director of My Heart is an Idiot, David Michaeljohn. David, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having us. Thank you.
Well, Davy, this film actually started out not as a quest for love, but as something quite different. Tell us how it got started.
Sure. You know, we make this magazine, Found magazine. It's all notes and letters that people have found on the ground, found on the street. And every year, for the last several years, me and my brother Peter drive around the country sharing our favorites of these finds with people. And David Michaeljohn, this talented filmmaker, decided he wanted to make a documentary about Found magazine. And he said he would come on one of these tours with us for a couple months. He jumped in the van. And when he got home from the tour, he started watching the footage, and he realized that what he'd actually documented was the ups and downs of my love life. So the documentary took another turn at that point, and he came on the road with us again the following year and filmed some more to see how all these stories would end up.
So, David Michaeljohn, did that development work with you, or were you remaining attached to the original idea?
Oh, no. I think to be a documentary filmmaker, you have to be adaptable, and you have to kind of follow the story that is the most interesting. And, you know, the found shows are really fun and entertaining, but the actual drama of the stuff that we had shot was clearly based on Davy's romantic life.
Yeah. Davy Rothbart, how yeah. confident can we be that what we're seeing is real?
Well, pretty confident. you know, I didn't know David that well when he started filming the movie. We became pretty good friends, and I've done some documentary filmmaking myself, and of course the work with This American Life. It's weird how quickly when you're interviewing someone they forget the microphone's there, or when you're filming someone they forget the camera's there. I was totally unaware of the camera. I just felt like I was hanging out with David, and there's stuff in the movie that I can't believe. Like, he was filming. I don't even remember him filming. I don't even remember him having the camera in those moments. So he caught some pretty raw moments, unflinching, I think you called him. He really dug in, but it's all real.
Yeah. David Michaeljohn, tell us about how you handle, as the director of a film that really depends for its power on the person or people who are being shot being as real as possible and not acting for the camera.
Well, a trick of the trade documentary work is I always kept the camera on me. Even when I wasn't recording, I would have the camera in my hands. That way, everybody around me just saw me with the camera at all times. So you really quickly develop, you get kind of used to seeing it around, and you don't even think about it. So Davy, like Davy said, he kind of forgot. He didn't know when I was running and when I wasn't, because I always had the camera on me. And also that coupled with the fact that Davy and I, you know, we're good friends and we liked each other, and I would just talk to him, and I would just look him in the eye when we were talking, and it was more just a conversation between two people instead of a conversation on camera.
Yeah. I'm talking with Davey Rothbart and David Michael John about the documentary film My Heart is an Idiot. It premiered earlier this year, and it's showing this Sunday night in Sacramento at the Guild Theater at 7:30, part of the Movies in a Big Screen series. David Michael John is a director, and Davey Rothbart is the subject of the film. He's also the creator of Found magazine, and he writes for other publications, and you've heard him many times on This American Life. I haven't actually seen the film. I haven't had a chance to see it yet, but I've seen a trailer, and I've read quite a bit about it. And Davey, it seems that you don't necessarily come across always too well in the film.
True. you know, he captured, I think love can make you do some pretty crazy things. And he definitely caught all the high moments, you know, the triumphant moments. He also caught the low down and the gutter ones. And, you know, it's hard to watch the movie for me sometimes, you know, because I see myself doing things I regret, being reckless with other people's emotions at times. And, you know, it's strange, but you learn a lot from watching it because, you know, it's easy in life to repeat your mistakes. But when you get to watch those mistakes hundreds of times, as David was putting the movie together, you know, you learn a lot. But that was what I told David when he started filming. I was like, you know what? We talked about it. And, you know, I said, film everything, you know. Later we can decide what's comfortable to put in it or not. He did have to talk me off the ledge when I first saw the movie, and I saw just how real it was, and the thing, some of the things he captured, I was like, no, I don't want people seeing that. But he was like, what about our agreement? And so it's all in there. It's all in there, and for better or worse, but it's human, I think. Just like when I read these found notes in Found magazine, you know, these are people's real notes, and people reveal themselves in raw and intimate ways. And, you know, I feel like I've been publishing other people's most private moments in Found magazine for almost 10 years now. It's the least I could do to open my life up in the same way.
David, was there anything that was so raw or negative or unflattering or whatever that you pleaded with Davey, but he would not relent and you had to cut it out?
No, I think I put the most raw, intense, embarrassing things in there, actually. I think, you know, the film definitely keeps the raw stuff there. Very, very rarely did Davey and I have disagreements on how the film should go. Davey is an incredible storyteller, and this is my first film, so I don't have the great history and experience of telling a story that Davey has. So I definitely exploited Davey's talents as much as I could. And as much as I filmed and edited the film myself, Davey was a very strong collaborator because I would show him scenes I edited, and we would have these long conversations about, do the scenes work? How do they work in the big story arc? And I learned a lot from Davey in editing this film, just about craft and storytelling.
But Davey, doesn't that create a conflict of interest perhaps for you? Because you're the subject of the film, but you're also helping to shape it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that while helping to shape it, I still didn't know where the story was going, and in a way. And I hadn't seen all the footage just the way David had. One choice that he made that I really like is that he really includes some of the other voices, some of the other people who are maybe the objects of my crushes and infatuations. They also narrate the film. So there's entire sections of the movie that I had never, you know, seen or didn't know anything about until I saw the movie for the first time.
I see. Davey, it's all very well for you to say, hey, it's my life, film it. But there are a lot of other people who are also in the film. Did you have to do a sales job with people to persuade them to do it? Did anyone who should have been in the film or could have been in the film say, no, I want nothing to do with it?
Well, no, that's a great question. And it's funny because a couple of the subjects of the film, they were pretty nervous about their participation in the movie until they saw it. And then and they loved it. They thought it was really fair. They come across really well. I don't always, but I think people were pretty nervous about it because, yeah, exactly. Like it's just because I'm putting my private life out in public doesn't mean that they should feel obligated to. But once they saw the film, they really loved it. One of the subjects is this girl named Alex who had been living in San Francisco for years, and she came to Michigan when we had the premiere a couple weeks ago, everyone that's in the movie has been really supportive of it.
We're talking about the documentary film My Heart is an Idiot. The subject is Davey Rothbart and his quest for love. David Michael John, you're the director. There are some people in the film who look who are quite set apart from the bulk of the action. Most of the film as far as I can tell, is very raw. They're very normal-looking people, but then you have some very well-known people in it, including Ira Glass and Newt Gingrich, which is kind of an interesting combination in itself. Why are these famous people in the film, too?
A lot of the people that give Davy advice on his love life are friends of his, people that know him really well. But then some people are that we just came across on our travels around the country, because we traveled for 2 months in 2005 and 2 months in 2006 in hundreds of cities across the country. And yeah. you meet a lot of interesting folks, and so we crossed paths with Ira Glass, and Davy knows Ira Glass from his work from the start of the life, so that was sort of easy to talk. But then accidentally, we just happened to be in Washington, D.C. at the Book Expo America when Gingrich was promoting his book, and Davy was promoting his book as well. And we just saw him, and we said, we should ask him love advice. Why not? Because Newt Gingrich is, you know, he has a big name. He's a, you know, a person that people recognize as a political figure, but he's also a person that has his own romantic experiences. So why not ask him for advice? I'm sure he's got his own, he has his own you know, trial and error phases in his romance. So I'm sure he has lessons that he could give to anybody.
And Davy, did he have good advice?
Weirdly, yes. I don't really agree with any of his political views, and yet he was one of the most thoughtful, reflective, and smart advice givers that we came across.
Mm. I guess advice could include don't split up with people when they're seriously ill.
Exactly. Well, and he's had his well-documented ups and downs. But as David said, you know, that, you know, you gain wisdom, I guess, through making those kinds of mistakes. So.
Mm. And finally, Davy Rothbart, why is the film called My Heart is an Idiot? Where does that phrase come from?
It's a cool story, actually. We have a good friend named Frank Warren who does a project called Post Secret, and he asked people to send him anonymous postcards declaring one of their secrets. And we were at his house in Maryland, and you know, he gets a couple hundred of these secrets a day, and we decided to go through them with him that day. And that was one of the secrets that came in the day we were at his house. That's it. One of the postcards someone had written, "My heart is an idiot," and we just thought that was the perfect phrase. We knew immediately. The moment's even in the film, because David was filming at the time, and we knew immediately that would be the title. And we joke about, you know, well, if we hadn't been there that day, if that postcard hadn't come in the mail, who knows what the movie would be called.
Wow. Well, My Heart is an Idiot, it's on tour, and this Sunday night it's in Sacramento at the Guild Theater, and it starts at 7:30. It's part of the Movies in a Big Screen series. The film was directed by David Michael John, and the subject of the film is Davy Rothbart. Davy, you often tour with your projects. Are you touring with the film?
Yep. Yeah, me and David are traveling around the country, sharing the movie with people, and then afterwards, and it's just a really fun movie, too, even though it deals with some serious stuff. People laugh a lot at it, which I think, to David Michelson's credit, how entertaining it is. And we thought we should be there to answer questions. People have a lot of questions after the movie. And after this movie, Sunday night at the Guild, we'll be there to talk to people and answer their questions and talk about love with people.
Great. Well, thanks both so much. I appreciate you joining us today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, you'll meet some members of Maniac. It's a collaborative of multimedia artists with a show opening this weekend in Sacramento. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. On Capital Public Radio News today, why the IRS has revoked the tax-exempt status of tens of thousands of organizations in California. That story and more on All Things Considered, starting at 4. A collaborative of multimedia artists is opening a show this weekend in Sacramento. The contributors are from all over the place, and the collaborative goes by the name of MANIAC. It's an acronym, so it's not just a word, a regular word. Joining us are a couple of the members of MANIAC. One of them is a co-founder, Kevin Daly, who's an artist and educator. And he lives in Connecticut. Kevin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And also in our studio is Andy Cunningham, who's a drawing teacher at Sacramento Country Day School, and he's a member of the collective MANIAC. Andy, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And we have on the phone Susan Schutten, who is an artist, art consultant, sculptor. She lives in Bridgeport, Connecticut. She's also one of the founders of MANIAC. Susan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me here. Nice to be with you all.
Great. Kevin, as one of the co-founders, can you decipher the acronym MANIAC for us? What does it mean, and why do you choose such an in-your-face kind of word?
Well, it was. It came from its Multimedia Artists Network Idea Exchange and Collaboration, and we set it up just to do all of those things, and it just seemed like, you know, a fun way to get that out there and describe it.
Yes. Now, Susan, whereabout are all the members based? I mean, we know for a fact at least two people are in Connecticut and Andy's in Sacramento. Are people from further afield too?
Yeah, they are. They're from all over. They're from California. They're from Nebraska. They're from Germany. They're from New York City. They are from France. I mean, just all over the world, really.
And what does it mean to be a member of Maniac? What do you get from being a member of Maniac, or what do you do to be a member of Maniac? Susan?
Are you asking me?
Yes, go ahead.
Basically, artists tend to kind of work in a singular way. You know, we work isolated, often by ourselves, unless we're specifically choosing to collaborate. So by joining the group Maniac, it, first of all, kind of allows us to elicit dialogue with each other and talk about commonalities that we have in our work or what's going on in the art world. So we take ourselves out of our, you know, our singular place, and we start to connect, you know, and not only with other artists, but also with the larger art world and just issues and things that are going on within it.
Now, Kevin, there are, of course, thousands, maybe even tens or hundreds of thousands of artists around the world. How is it that these particular artists from all over the place join Maniac? What is it that draws those people? What is it that unifies them as opposed to all the other artists who are not members of Maniac?
Well, we're working, and it was set up as a group through Facebook, so it's all networked through our friends and, you know, artists that we know either, you know, locally or just through Facebook. So it's, you know, just networking.
Okay.
In that way.
Andy, you live in you work in Sacramento.
Yes.
You're also a member of Maniac. Why did you join?
Kevin asked me to join Maniac. We went to grad school together.
And oh, where was that?
At Hunter College in New York City.
Okay.
And he had set up Maniac for studio visits and then asked me to join Maniac. And this was back in 2009. And I was like, don't really do Facebook, but I'll join, because he was like, well, people post articles, they post images, they do all these things that don't normally come through like your mailbox, your personal mailbox.
Yeah.
And so I joined, and then he had the opportunity to do Maniac 1. This version here in Sacramento is Maniac 2. So.
And roughly how many Maniac collaborative artist members are there in the Sacramento area, as far as you know?
Me.
Just you?
Yes.
And Susan, what about overall? How many?
Oh, sorry. There's one in Stockton. So if you would call that,
sure. We'll consider that part of the
And I did not know that artist whatsoever until 2009, when she was also in that show. So.
And Susan, what about overall? How many people are members of Maniac?
Oh, gee, Kevin would probably know a little bit better, but it started off with like 5 or 6. And I think within just a few days, like 5 days, it grew to 50. And then I think after that, it grew to a couple hundred. And we might be so much stronger and bigger than that now, Kevin.
I actually, the last time I looked at it, it was like 125
okay.
people.
And how many people are featured in this show that opens in Sacramento this weekend?
I think it's like 23.
Okay, so a couple of dozen artists.
Yes.
And who are they? I mean, are they from all over the
yeah,
country?
Yeah, the French and German artists are here in town. They came to be here for the show and install their work. And Kevin and Suzanne are here. Susan's in Stockton. And Kevin is here. And I think the artists from Petaluma and the one from Oakland and the one from San Francisco, she lives in San Francisco and L.A., they'll also be coming to the show. So,
and Andy, are you exhibiting in the show?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. What kind of works are you showing?
I'm showing some small round paintings that kind of strapped to the wall, I guess, is for lack of a better word.
What do you mean strapped to the wall?
They're round, and then instead of using the wire that you would use on the back of a painting to hang, it's that wire is holding the round painting kind of vertically off the wall.
I see. So these are paintings, although you teach drawing at Sacramento Country Day School. So, but I guess your comfort zone as an artist is painting then. Not necessarily.
It's painting and drawing is my kind of like zone.
Okay. Kevin, are you exhibiting?
Yes.
What do you have showing? And generally speaking, what kind of art do you do?
My work is geometric abstractions. It's sort of informed by like minimalism and pop art. And what I'm doing in this show is I have a decal made, like a large decal, which is going to sort of integrate the image with the architecture. It's going to fold around the wall and floor.
Yeah.
So it's.
And Susan, are you exhibiting in the show?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. Can you tell us what it is you're showing and what kind of artwork do you do generally?
Okay. The piece that I'm doing is called Cluster, and it's just made up of lots of little tiny pieces of very colorful paper that just kind of get built together. It's a sculptural relief from the wall, and it's a lot of my pieces are relatively kind of body size. They're larger, and my work in general, like many of the people in the group, it really just kind of addresses this ethereal nature of materials in art, you know, and that includes everything like color as light and emotion, or mark making shape and form is kind of eliciting a dialogue with space. And with architecture, a lot of our work really interacts with the architecture of a space.
Well, just listening to the three of you describe what you're doing, what you've done for this show, it sounds like the show is quite eclectic. When people walk in to see it, are they going to feel like there's some unified theme to the show?
Absolutely. The work all comes together through this kind of dialogue with shape, form, and color. So, and, you know, this sense of abstraction. There's a lot of abstraction in the show.
Yeah. Now, this show that we're talking about opens tomorrow, June 11th, at the Brick House Art Gallery in Sacramento. Andy, that's in Oak Park, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It's a beautiful old brick building.
It is an old brick building, yes.
And so it opens on basically for second Saturday.
Yep. Yeah. It'll be open second Saturday, and through the month there's a number that you can contact. You can contact me, basically.
Okay. So. Brick House Art Gallery is easy to find online.
Yes.
And then I understand there's going to be another Maniac exhibit opening July 25th at the Reynolds Gallery at University of the Pacific in Stockton. Kevin, is that the same show moving south or is it a different show?
No, it's the same show. I don't know to what extent the breadth of it will be exactly the same, but it's, you know, it's the same Hit by the Eidolon, which is, you know, moving from this gallery up there.
I see. Well, thanks so much. We've been talking about an exhibit put together by the artist collective Maniac, which stands for Multimedia Artist Network Idea Exchange and Collaboration. The artists who are part of Maniac come from across the country and even around the world. And several of those artist members are exhibiting at the show that opens tomorrow night at the Brick House Art Gallery in Sacramento and then moves to Stockton in July and August. In our studio, Andy Cunningham, drawing teacher at Sacramento Country Day School and a member of Maniac, and Kevin Daly, who lives in Connecticut, and he's one of the founders of Maniac. And on the phone, Susan Schutan, who's an artist, also lives in Connecticut and one of the founders of Maniac. Thanks all so much for joining us and best wishes for the show.
Thank you very
Thanks
much.
For having us.
Thank you so very much.
And that's Insight for today and for this week. Today's associate producers, Lynn Weaver and Christine Guerra. The technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We'll be back on Monday. The commission that's literally redrawing California's political districts has released the first draft of its maps. On the next Insight, we'll talk with a redistricting commission member about how they created those maps. Also, Sacramento Police Chief Rick Brazil on how his department plans to respond to proposed cuts. And continuing the conversation, a documentary about end-of-life care debuts in Folsom. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Monday morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.